Writer Ray Bradbury was an enduring American icon. His work straddled genres, uniting the seemingly disparate worlds of science fiction and high literature, haunting readers' imaginations with captivating visions of sideshows, skeletons, lakes and ravines, bright stars and the dark skies of space, front porches and late-night train whistles. When he died in 2012, Bradbury left behind several generations of fans. One of those fans, Sam Weller, was lucky enough to get to know Bradbury, the man, during the last decade of his life. His extensive research and intimate knowledge of Bradbury's life came together in a 2005 biography, The Bradbury Chronicles. He'll be reading from that biography and doing a Q&A on the life and work of Ray Bradbury at the Mid-Continent Public Library's Woodneath facility this evening. That will be at 7 o'clock tonight. For now, we're honored to have him joining us here. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
So tell me a little bit about how you got to know Ray Bradbury.
You know, he loved this story very much. My father read Bradbury to my mom when I was 8 months in utero. And would read aloud to her. And so I really encountered him before I was born, and he thought that sounded like a Bradburyan concept in and of itself. I grew up, like so many young adult readers, discovering his works and falling in love with the sort of lyricism, the melancholy, the high imagination, and the very, as you said, high literary quality to his work, and just gravitated towards it. The ideas are fantastic and fanciful, and I think in some ways they're sort of an adult version of Harry Potter on a lot of levels. So I love them, and I read them as a teenager. And then when I went into writing myself, and he was a huge reason I did that, as a journalist, I interviewed him for a cover story for the Chicago Tribune magazine in 2000. It was the year he was turning 80, and I profiled him for the magazine. And we hit it off. That first interview lasted 6 hours. It was incredible. And he knew that I had read all of his works and was very steeped in his life fantastic, as you will.
Well, one of the tidbits in your book that I enjoyed was just a subtle thing in there, but that he claimed to not have a favorite among his books, but that his wife confided in you that Dandelion Wine was his favorite. What about you? Do you have a favorite?
You've read very closely. I do. It alternates. I teach the only college-level class in America on him at Columbia College Chicago, where I'm a professor, and I tend to assign his short stories. There's a terrific short story collection called The Stories of Ray Bradbury, and it culls 100 of his greatest short stories in one place. And his wife always felt that his greatest mastery was the short story. He wrote, of course, screenplays and theatrical plays and did architectural renderings and wrote novels, of course, and essays and poetry and on and on and on. But I concurred with his wife that I think his finest avocation, if you will, was the short story.
Something really beautiful from your introduction to your book is just about the idea of Bradbury belonging to all generations. Tell me about your generation and what Bradbury means to that generation, and then maybe explain what you mean about him belonging to all generations.
You know, he lived such a long life that he really did write for several generations. Beginning, his first publications came out during World War II, and so the GIs of World War II were reading his stories in the pulp fiction magazines in the early to mid-1940s. And he went on, the boomers claimed him as their own, and my generation, as you said, I fall into Generation X, gravitated towards him because of his pop cultural cross-pollination. He's a man who, as I said, not only worked in literature, but worked in film and radio, theater, and on. And I think he's one of the first writers to really cross-pollinate across all forms of multimedia. And so I think because Generation X is so often connected to pop culture, I think that is my generation's connection to him. He had a television program in the mid-1980s to early 90s called the Ray Bradbury Theater that started on HBO far before HBO became sort of the penultimate place for dramatic television. He had the vision and insight to go there with his series, and it was very Twilight Zonian, if you will, or Outer Limits kind of television. He won 12 Cable Ace Awards for doing that. And so I think I encountered him in my classrooms reading his books. I encountered him at home in my living room on his television. When seeing reruns of The Twilight Zone, he wrote episodes of that on occasion, and of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And so it seemed like everywhere you went, into every cellar and every attic, there was some connection to Ray Bradbury.
That you have chosen cellars and attics strikes me as not coincidental, but we'll get back to that in a second, because I really want to ask you about this. Just do I remember correctly that Illustrated Man was your introduction to Bradbury?
It was. Very good memory. That was the book, in fact, that my dad read to my mom, and I always laugh because it's a rather dystopic, frightening work of fiction. It's about a tattooed carnival freak who's body is covered in skin illustrations, and every tattoo is a short story in the collection, and some of them are not very pretty pictures. They're rather disarming and frightening and thought provoking and nightmarish, if you will. And so that was the first book that my dad read to my poor pregnant mother, but she loved Bradbury as well. And that's the same book I plucked off my father's bookshelf when I was 11 and fell in love with it. Again, it's just the ideas are very cinematic. I think I would argue to the ends of the earth that Ray Bradbury is really the first literary writer to be profoundly influenced by cinematic concepts. He grew up with movies. He was born in 1920, and he went to the films, the double matinees and so on throughout the 20s and 30s. And his sense of storytelling was very shaped by the very visual nature of film, the high conceptual nature of Hollywood movies. And I think he brought a lot of that cinematic influence into his writings.
How do you see that, for example, in Illustrated Man? Let's turn to a specific story like The Veldt. That is a story that, I mean, as a reader myself, I see as very contemporary for us now, and as far as virtual worlds and so forth. Maybe could you give us a summary of that story and talk about how you see that as being a very cinematically told tale?
Sure. The Veldt is one of his best-known stories. It's often collected in great anthologies of short literature, such as the Norton Anthology of Fiction. He wrote it in November of 1949. He wrote it in 2 hours, which is remarkable. The first draft, he was a very quick writer, and he had this idea. His wife was pregnant with their first daughter, and he was starting to contemplate what the nursery of the future would be like. Bradbury is often associated with science fiction, but as you stated at the top, he's much, much more. I would argue that he's a literary writer who wrote fantasy, science fiction, and contemporary prose, amongst other things. But The Veldt is an example of his speculative fiction or science fiction. And so he was 29 years old at the time and thought, posited, what would the nursery of the future be like? And television at the time was in its very, very infancy. Again, it was at the tail end of 1949, and television was just starting to infiltrate into the living rooms of America. And he projected, if you will, where TV might go. And in his imagination, it would become wall-to-wall. It would become interactive. It would be sort of a virtual reality, which was a term that I don't think even existed when he wrote the story. But again, it's about two young children who go into this virtual world, and they can program it and imagine whatever setting and characters they want and engage and interact with them. And they are going in there on a daily basis, and the parents discover that they're out there, out in the wilds of Africa, on the landscapes with the lions and the giraffes, and the children are picnicking out there amongst this very terrifying and dangerous and primitive landscape, and the parents are frightened by it and eventually become concerned that the children are a little too addicted to this television nursery, if you will, and endeavor to take them away from it. It's time to wean them from this technology, and the children aren't happy about that. So I think if you reflect upon when he wrote it, more than 60 years ago, 65 years ago, it's pretty prescient that he was able to envision that television would become this sort of babysitter for our children. And that's one thing that he was daring to sort of address with the story.
I was interested to read in your book that that the science fiction enthusiasts of his time didn't necessarily embrace him early in his career for precisely what you're kind of describing, which is that he expressed misgivings about technology and science rather than painting a rosy picture of the future that could be created by them.
That's really fascinating. I think he was always sort of ostracized by not only the science fiction community, and he was friends. I mean, one of his early mentors was Robert Heinlein. Bradbury was part of a sort of science fiction group in Los Angeles when he was in his late teens, and Heinlein was a writer in that group and helped him nurture his skills a bit. But the science fiction community never embraced Ray Bradbury because they always looked at his technology as flawed. Bradbury didn't concern himself at all with technology. He wrote about it. He wrote mostly cautionary tales about technology in the hands of human beings who don't know what to do with it. He looked at technology as this sort of razor wire where there's two sides that we could fall on. You can either use technology to advance us or you could use technology to destroy us. For example, nuclear technology could be used for medicine to cure our cancers, or it could be used to annihilate our planet. And he was always fascinated not by technology, but technology in the hands of humanity and the human choice. Bradbury was a deeply and profoundly human writer, and I think that was always one of my great attractions to him. He didn't care so much about how many gigabytes a rocket ship's computer had. That didn't interest him at all. He cared about who was steering the rocket ship and why they were on it and what would happen to them.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Sam Weller, author of a Ray Bradbury biography titled The Bradbury Chronicles, and he'll be speaking this evening at the Woodneath facility of the Mid-Continent Public Library. We're really lucky to have him talking with us this morning. And Sam, let's talk a little bit about Bradbury the man. Let's go back to his childhood, which you've captured really beautifully in this book. He claims to remember his birth.
This is a very controversial topic. Over the years, he lectured across the world and would go on talk shows. He was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson twice and The Dick Cavett Show and all the great talk shows of the 60s and 70s. And he often told the story of his birth memory. He claimed till the very day he passed away that he recalled his birth. And whenever he would tell this story, there would be snickers. People would laugh, chuckle, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You know, here's a creative eccentric who probably is using his incredible imagination to help himself believe that he recalls his own birth. And that certainly was my own take on it. The first time I walked into his home and said, okay, I've read you tell your birth story. Can we talk about this? And he said, well, it sounds like you don't believe me either. But over the years, I'll be honest with you, and I'm sure our listeners right now won't buy what I'm going to say, but after spending 12 years working very intimately with the man, thousands of hours of interviews, staying at his home, going through every nook and cranny of the man's house and of his life, I leave this experience. I really don't leave it because it continues to this day, but I take away from it fully believing the man when he says he remembers his birth story. And he was born on August 22nd, 1920 at 4:50 in the afternoon. I think it's funny, had it been 1 minute later, it would have been 4:51, which of course would have connected to one of his most famous books. But he started to have sort of dreamlike memories of his birth. And when he was in his late 20s, he called his mother and said, Mom, I'm having these sort of mosaic flashes, these pieces of fragmented memory of my birth. He recalled where the windows were in the room. He recalled how many people were there. He recalled the color of the tiles. I mean, odd details. And he called his mom and asked her, and his mom was Bradbury called her a very stoic Swede. She was born in Sweden, and he always said her corset was buttoned up too tight. She was very rigid and firm, and his mother accepted that her son was eccentric and imaginative and wildly creative, but when he called her that day and remembered his birth to her, she was dumbfounded. Her jaw dropped, and she said, but how is it that you know all these details? Because this is exactly the case. You know, a lot of psychologists have said that it's impossible, that the brain isn't developed enough. But I come away from it thinking that, you know, that I think geniuses in our world use a capacity of their brain or a portion of their minds that perhaps the rest of us don't always utilize. And I think Ray Bradbury, having spent so much time with him, no doubt in my mind was a genius. His formal education ended at high school, yet he was able to accomplish as much as he did. And I left thinking that I think this man has a cerebral capacity that not many people do. And who am I to say he doesn't remember being born?
You recount some stories in his childhood and how those tie into his literature and how those his memory how he as an adult interacted with his childhood memories through literature. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it does sound like in general his relationship with his own memory was unusual.
It really was. I mean, I think a lot of people call him nostalgic or sentimental. And I think sometimes, you know, you've talked about the science fiction community keeping him at arm's distance. And the literary community at times has kept him at arm's distance because he's nostalgic. Or, you know, he hails from the romantic literary tradition, in my estimation. I think he celebrates life in the universe, and I think he comes from the tradition of William Butler Yeats. In fact, he named a book The Golden Apples of the Sun and named another book I Sing the Body Electric, one for Yeats, one for Walt Whitman, and he read Robert Frost. And Bradbury was romantic to the very core of his heart, and I think he brought that romance and zest for life, living, and the universe to his fictions and all of his writings, for that matter. I'm sorry, I detoured from your question.
How his interactions with his own memory played out through his literary explorations, through the process of writing.
To me, it's fascinating because he's always associated with speculative fiction and writing about the future and writing about the impossible. But yet, as I've read all of his works and studied him and I teach him, there's a profound element of autobiography to all of his writings. So, for example, if he writes something like The Martian Chronicles, which is just really a story cycle, it's collected short stories about the colonization of Mars. Well, he brings, in many ways, his own small town, Waukegan, Illinois, to the surface of Mars in that book, in one story. Bradbury grew up on the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. He loved Poe. And there's a short story in The Martian Chronicles called Usher 2 about a man who builds a second house of Usher on Mars. I think the success of Bradbury is that he never abandoned his childhood passions or his loves and interests, and he reexamined all of them in his writings through the maturity of being an adult literary writer. But the first time I interviewed him, I said, why has it been so essential to you to go back to your childhood so often in books like Dandelion Wine, which is a beautiful novel and stories about growing up in the summer of 1928. All of his books have elements of his childhood in it. And he said, you know, it's very important that we don't abandon our root system, that we don't abandon where we came from, and that if you revisit the things you were passionate about as a child, but write about them as an adult, interesting things are going to happen.
There's a story you tell in the book that I'm hoping you'll tell our listeners now, not to spoil your book for anyone who's planning on reading it, but in the Bradbury Chronicles, you talk about a certain Mr. Electrico and the phrase live forever. It's a really haunting and inspiring at the same time kind of story.
I'm glad you asked about that because it's his favorite story. It was his favorite story to tell. I still grapple with speaking of him in the past tense. When he was 12 years old, he would sneak out of his house before sunrise with his older brother and walk down to the lakefront of Lake Michigan in Waukegan, Illinois, and watch the carnivals and circuses arrive. And he loved that form of entertainment. And on Labor Day weekend in 1932, as he recalled, there was a carnival there called the Dill Brothers Combined Shows. And he went into a magic show where a performer named Mr. Electrico would strap himself into an electric chair, and he had an Excalibur sword at the side of the chair, and an assistant would strap him in and pull a lever and charge him full of thousands of volts of electricity, and Mr. Electrico's hair would rise on end, and his teeth would glow, and his eyes would glow, and then the assistant would unshackle him, and Mr. Electrico would rise from the chair and pick the sword up and walk into the crowd and begin to tap the children in the audience on the shoulders or on their foreheads, and they could feel the voltaic charge of the electricity flowing from his body through that Excalibur sword and into them. The hair on their arms would rise and on the back of their necks, and they would get this static charge through the sword. And he came to young Ray Bradbury, 12-year-old Ray Bradbury, sitting there at the end of the front row, and tapped him on the left shoulder and then the right and then the tip of his nose and said, "Live forever." And Ray Bradbury, sitting there bespectacled and all of 12 and very skinny, looked up at him and thought, you know, this man just went through the audience and tapped everybody with the sword, but he didn't say live forever to anybody else but him. And he went home that day and thought, why did he say that to me? And the story goes on. He did. I mean, the story is much more detailed, and I chronicle it in my book and even my own investigations into who Mr. Electrico might have been. But he did find out, because 2 weeks after that encounter with this, you know, two-bit sort of Depression-era carnival performer, Bradbury started to write short stories 2 weeks after that, and he never stopped. And so his immortality, we're sitting here talking about him right now on your program and again this evening at the library, he will live forever. I think that his stature in the pantheon of literature is only going to increase, so he will live forever.
I'm going to just acknowledge right now, in case it's not already clear, that I also am a Ray Bradbury fan. And one of my favorite books is partly one of my favorites because of the foreword he wrote to it. It's The October Country. And in this foreword, the foreword is actually titled, "May I Die Before My Voices." Can you explain what he means by that? What his voices are and why he hoped to not outlive them?
Oh, he always maintained that he had this night theater in his mind, that when he would go to bed at night, he would let these night voices talk, and he would sleep. And he was a huge believer in the majesty of the subconscious when it comes to creativity, that the conscious isn't nearly as intelligent as the unconscious. And so these voices, this theater of the mind, as he called it, would solve his stories and would create stories while he slept. And he was very much a morning writer and would leap out of bed and rush to his typewriter while he maintained he was still in that very subconscious, woozy dream state and get those ideas down. He was a huge believer in that. I marveled at the weight and power that he placed on his subconscious. That's why he was a quick writer, because he didn't believe in bringing the intellectual process into your early writing stages, because he always thought that you could overthink your stories and scar them and damage them and overthink your art. He would always maintain, let your subconscious tell it. And only in the rewriting stage or the polishing stage or the stage of perfection should intellectual process creep into creativity. So that's what he was really sort of getting at in that introduction to The October Country. That's a marvelous book. And it's really, Stephen King called that book The Dubliners of American Gothic. You know, it's a frightening book, but it's also a nostalgic book. It's a dark book. It's Bradbury looking at American horror as only Bradbury could do. There's a melancholy to the stories. There's fairy tales in that book. It's just a remarkable book.
Speaking of melancholy, one last question for you, Sam Weller, about Ray Bradbury before we have to go. What, as a friend of his, what do you miss most about him?
Oh, wow. That's a terrific question. You know, I think about him every day. Yesterday I was just walking around my house thinking, my gosh, I miss him. He was this dichotomous figure in my life. Certainly I was his biographer. I not only did the Bradbury Chronicles, but subsequently I've done a book of interviews with him called Listen to the Echoes. And I edited a book that won the Bram Stoker Award last year called Shadow Show, which is a collection of short stories written in his tradition by people like Dave Eggers, Margaret Atwood, Neil Gaiman. He's a towering figure in my life and always will be. So I not only have had this role as his authorized biographer that I've taken very seriously because of my passions for his creativity and his life. But I have this role as a scholar in bringing his works to new generations and studying him so I might discover more about him. But along with those two things, he was also very much a father figure to me. He worried about me. He called me very late at night. He was a night owl, no surprise, and would call at 1 a.m. and check in. He cared for me greatly and really took me under his wing, as it were. He also was a deep creative mentor to me. He was very interested, invested in my own writing and creative process, and he really wanted me to carry on writing in his tradition. I have my MFA in fiction, and I teach fiction, and I've been working on a lot of short stories. In fact, I have one on Amazon.com right now called Roadside Cross that is very much hails from October Country. And so he was this creative mentor, this dad, this journalistic subject. And he was also really a gregarious, bombastic, fun man, even into his 80s and into his early 90s. He was wonderful to be around. He loved great food. He loved entertainment. He loved going out and socializing. He was very outgoing and extroverted, and he was just this thrill to be around. I've never met anybody in my own lifetime who had a greater gratitude for living than that man did. And I miss being around that gratitude.
Do you think that accounts for, you've written about his tendency to cry, and to cry easily, not in just sadness, but in joy?
Absolutely. I mean, he did. He cried every day, and most of them were tears of joy, tears of laughter. He was a very emotional man, and I think part of that connects to the fact that his own connection to childhood, and he didn't completely abandon the boy within him. And I think that that was a large part of his success, is that he didn't give up a certain aspect of his persona that was childlike and filled with childlike wonder. And so with that, he was very emotional, which was good and bad. I mean, he could have, you know, tantrums, and he could have, you know, moments of where he needed a timeout. but at the same time, I mean, every time we walked outside, he remarked about the hue of the sunshine or the way the leaves looked in the afternoon. I mean, he noticed details. It was almost a poet's observation for details every minute of his life. And it was really influential to be around. I miss that greatly.
Well, that's all the time we have for this great conversation about Ray Bradbury with Sam Weller, author of The Bradbury Chronicles. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us today, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
To hear more about Sam Weller and from him, head to the Mid-Continent Public Library's Woodneath Auditorium this evening at 7. Details on the talk and the Woodneath location are online at mymcpl.org. That's mymcpl.org. You can hear past conversations or download a podcast of today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us tomorrow for an update on the ecosystem in and around the Missouri River. We'll check in on an endangered species, the pallid sturgeon, with its unique dinosaur-like appearance, while learning about the state of the Muddy Mo in general. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Linda Scher is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're headed on out for today, but stay tuned for Up to Date next.